From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Lake Effect's Bonnie North catches up with New York Times Berlin correspondent Melissa Eddy and talks about the rise of right-wing politics in Germany.
Later, how the life of a transracial adoptee in a Wisconsin small town informs a film in the works.
It's not just a story about adoption. It's not just a story about feeling outside of your community. It's like the combination of those two and all of the things that I had to go through as I was growing up.
And a new spin on the corporate cafeteria, how the micro market steers employees to healthy food choices.
We downplay some of the treats and snacks. Yes, we have them available, but I have to be honest, most people gravitate towards the fresh salad. They're going to grab that. They're going to grab a hot sandwich quicker than they're going to grab Doritos.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In the internet era, the lines between local and national and international news are blurred. If you want to read a story from the newspaper in Helsinki, Finland, or Johannesburg, South Africa, it just takes a few clicks of a mouse or taps on your smartphone and you're there.
That's a news climate that has evolved since Melissa Eddy began covering Europe for the Associated Press in 1997. Her first posting was in Vienna, then Frankfurt, then Berlin. She later became a correspondent for the International Herald Tribune for its last year of existence. That newspaper evolved and is now the international edition of the New York Times, which means Eddy is writing about Germany both for Americans at home and readers in Europe.
Lake Effect's Bonnie North in Berlin on a fellowship caught up with Melissa Eddy, who has been reporting from Germany as long as Angela Merkel has been chancellor there. It's a situation Eddy says will soon be over.
This is definitely the end. I think she really struggled with the decision whether she should run this time. And I know there's been some reporting out of the States that it had to do with Trump and all. I actually believe that decision was taken on her part even before the U.S. election, and it had largely to do with a sense of responsibility that she felt to her party, because she had not really groomed a successor. There was nobody obvious who could take over, but also to the political situation that she had started with her migration policy. And I think she was very aware of the fact that she was responsible for this and felt a need to see that through to the best of her ability. Whether that decision was a wise one, because over the arc of post-war German history, we've seen chancellors who stay into a fourth term tend to stumble in that term, and we're seeing Merkel doing that right now. And so the big question is more, will she serve out the end of this four-year term? Or will she actually end up leaving in some circumstance, whether she's voted out or whether she steps down of her own accord? That's the bigger question right now.
In 2015, when this big wave of migration and Syrian refugees basically hit Europe, she was lauded, at least in the international press, as someone with this huge heart and with this wonderful sense of, we are responsible for our fellow human beings. What changed?
It's interesting. I think she actually completely lost the narrative on that, because Germans, the majority of Germans, felt that way as well. And there were these incredibly emotional scenes of Germans who were turning out to help these refugees. They were showing up to greet them as they got off of buses, as they arrived at train stations. They came with food, they came with clothing, they came with toys for the children. It was almost surreal in this way, but it was also very palpable. There were a lot of older Germans, especially, who either remembered being refugees themselves from East Germany coming to West, or going even further back, those who remembered their parents talking about being refugees coming from the eastern parts of Europe that had been German before World War II. And after World War II, there was this massive influx of German refugees, if you will, into German territory. And that really marked the lives of many, many people. And so that outpouring, that generosity, that was all lost as we started to see the rise of attacks in the end of 2015. There were a series, there was a backpack bomber in someone who had come in as a refugee who tried to, he had a bomb in a backpack. It didn't explode, but that was done in Bavaria. And then there was another young refugee who had taken an axe and attacked several people on a train. These were in the summer of 2015. And that was the first time that people started to think, ooh, what have we done? Then there was the ISIS attack that we had on the Christmas market here in Berlin several months later. And that was when fear really started to take over. And then the backlash began really against this idea of we are giving these people so much and they are posing a threat to our society. What is unfortunate is that there are success stories of refugees who are learning German, who are contributing to the economy, and Germany needs people to contribute to the economy. Germany is desperate for young men to fill a lot of just basic labor jobs that the Germans, there are not enough Germans to fill. And unfortunately, that has become a lot more difficult since we've had this political shift, where what happened then is the anger and the backlash of the German people fed into the party of the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, that runs a very hard anti-refugee line, and who did quite well in the elections last year and are now the strongest opposition force in parliament.
Every German that I've spoken to here, whether they're in the media or not, has kind of quaked in their boots a little bit when you mention the AfD. I say, are you frightened of these people? And they essentially say yes. Is that the feeling you live here? Is that the feeling you're getting from people? Or are people just being somewhat disingenuous about that?
I think there is a genuine fear. Germany has been a very consensus-driven country. And even when you had the center-right party of the Christian Democrats, which is Merkel's party, in government with the center-left party, which is sort of the Labour Party, the Social Democrats, they found a way to agree. You didn't have these kind of other side of the aisle divisive splits that have been around in the United States now for quite a while. So for the first time, they're seeing a party that is not going along with consensus. And that's worrying. Germans are people who crave stability. What we as Americans often find boring, they think is, you know, comfortable, cozy, Gemütlichkeit. They have this word for it. Picketed fences, tidy yards, Sunday afternoon coffees at grandma. They like a predictability to things on many, many levels, including in politics. And so to have that thrown out of whack so vehemently, really, by a party that also, and this is where I think a lot of the fear is coming from, is that the AfD is a party that for the first time is questioning some of the ground principles of post-war Germany's attitude towards its Nazi history. And that has never been done before, and people don't know how to respond to it. And that's what's creating the fear in many cases, I think.
Yeah. Wasn't there somebody who stood up in the Bundestag and basically said, essentially, it's just not that important. The Nazi era just wasn't that important.
We've seen several of the leading members of the AfD make comments like that. Alexander Gauland, who's one of the co-leaders, he wasn't speaking in parliament, but he was addressing an assembly somewhere, and he said he thinks it's unfortunate that Germans are taught to concentrate so much on the Nazi past, which was actually just a bird poop in the arc of great German history. And remarks like that make a lot of people uneasy. And then in the East, where there's a whole nother set of issues sort of driving the popularity of the AfD, which are linked to the disenchantment that many people felt with how reunification went down, which in their eyes effectively was that the West came in and sort of usurped their culture, their country. And even though they spoke the same language, you know, people often will make the comparison to me. It would be like if Britain came back and tried to take over the United States again, right? You all had to drink tea,
which drive we drive on the left.
Drive on the left, exactly. You know, it had to be American football, and we'd have to call soccer football. Little things, but things that, when you think about it, are really essential to your identity and to your way of life and to who you understand yourself as being. And we're seeing now this generation who were teens or in their early 20s when the wall fell, and they're now reaching the ends, you know, they're starting to look towards the ends of their working career and trying to make plans for their further lives. They're seeing their children growing up, and they're asking questions about their retirement. Will they have enough money in their funds? Will their jobs still be? And they're looking back to what their parents went through at this time, and their parents were living in a completely different society, a society where they had very little, maybe, but everybody knew what everybody had, and there was this equality, and I think there's this longing for that. So these people then are thinking, we brought down a government that we didn't like in 1989 by taking to the streets. We're going to do that again because we don't like this government, because instead of spending money helping us get jobs or educate our children, they're spending money on these foreigners who are coming in and who are attacking us. And the AFD is very sensitive to that, and they're very savvy about that, and they have been playing into a lot of those fears in a way that people are responding to. And I think it's creating a rift in German society unlike anything that I've seen in my time here.
How much do you think what happened in the 2016 elections in the U.S. has affected what the AFD is doing? Are they looking across the pond and saying, huh?
Absolutely. They're not even looking, you don't even need to look across the pond. They're opening up their Twitter feeds. They all follow the U.S. president. And if the U.S. president, and this is someone who, if we go back and pause for a moment and think of when Obama campaigned before his first election, he was able to attract 100,000 people around the victory column in the heart of Berlin as a senator campaigning for U.S. president. This is John F. Kennedy, especially in this city, was viewed as a guarantor of safety and security for the city, the then divided city of Berlin. U.S. presidents are held in extremely high regard. So to have a U.S. president now equivocating both sides of the divide on what we saw in Charlottesville, saying that there were bad people on both sides when some of those people were carrying Nazi symbols that are illegal to carry on the open street in this country. You can be arrested and go to jail for it. Of course, that gives them a feeling that, well, if he can do it, so can we.
There are symbols.
Yes.
In a way.
There are. Yes, absolutely.
So what do you think is going to happen going forward if Merkel steps down or does finish out her 4 years but then is gone? Is there any indication about what the government might look like?
At this point, no, there's not any indication what the government might look like. It's one thing we are seeing, interestingly enough, is a rise of the Greens, who are sort of left, definitely left of center. They're definitely pro-refugee, including being pro-environment. And as the Social Democrats, the Labour Party, are losing popularity because they have been unable to translate their support for jobs to the new gig economy that is starting here, a lot of support now is heading to the Greens. They don't have the kind of support that Merkel's party has. However, I think they would probably be in some form represented in a future government. I don't think the AFD, despite it all, has the strength at the federal level that we would see them in government anytime soon in Berlin. But I think, well, in Berlin, I mean, as in Germany, with Berlin as the capital. In the city of Berlin, I don't think so either. But in several of the other former eastern states, we may be seeing governors from the AFD and governments with the AFD possibly participating. They're very, very popular there.
Well, the rise of populism has seemed to be it's going up. I mean, for the last couple of years across Europe and certainly in the U.S., we've been seeing that too. And I find that just troubling in general, that we're on that end of the pendulum swing. It seems to be whether people didn't recover from the 2008 recession, whatever the reasons are, it just seems like there's so much more of this poking its head up over the parapet.
I think that's definitely true. I don't, obviously, you know, in Germany, in the U.S., there are different reasons that are driving this. 2008 for Europe was very difficult. Germany actually managed to fare quite well. The government stepped in and helped provide funding for companies so that they could scale down working hours, but still keep a lot of people in work, and that managed to help, that allowed them to finesse sort of their way through 2008, but the collapse virtually of the euro and Greece, that really battered Europe as a whole. And that is one of the effects that we're seeing with the rise of populism in Europe, is that the European Union as a project, first of all, has been battered by Brexit, with the Brits voting to leave the European Union, which was largely driven by nationalism and populism. But at the same time, we're seeing the rise of nationalism and populism on the eastern flank in countries like Poland, in countries like Hungary. And if you think back to 2015 and when there were all of these refugees coming, at that point, they were arriving in Hungary and Hungary didn't want them. And we had scenes that were unprecedented in modern Europe of people crammed into the train station in Hungary. The trains were not running. The Hungarian government had said, nobody else is leaving. We're not sending them west. And this is where Merkel said, okay, they can come to Germany. That was driven by the Hungarian rejection of all of these refugees. And so now this problem that at the time was in Hungary, sort of Germany took on. So there's a whole, the system is crumbling, and it's disturbing. The European Union has been such a guarantor of prosperity and wealth and ease of travel and, you know, free movement of goods. And it's, I have a hard time imagining the idea of Europe going backwards, and yet there are those who seem very determined to take it in that way.
Yeah, it's almost as if they look at it as an antiquated system and they no longer want to be a part of it.
Right. And there's also in the East the problem that they look at it as, we shook off this outer power from Moscow and now we've got Brussels telling us what to do. This is not what we signed up for. Although it's very different, again, this opens the door for these populist narratives. And I think the European Union has also been extremely bad at you know, promoting its own narrative. And I remember going 2 years ago to Budapest for the first time in over a decade. And it was unbelievable how the streets of the Hungarian capital had been transformed. There were playgrounds, there were new trams, and it was all money. Everywhere you went, there were these little blue flags from the EU saying this project was funded by the European Union. So there definitely are positive aspects of it, and yet the people in those societies are somehow not seeing that and not understanding that. And I think that really is a failing of of Western leaders and of European Union leaders, that they haven't been able to transmit what everybody has gained from this project. And of course it's not perfect and it's hard, like democracy is, and it's messy and somebody gets more at some point and gets less at another, right? It's all the give and take of the things that we know. But in a lot of these Eastern European countries, I don't know that they understand how, well, it's not that they don't understand. It's just the societies seem to be lapsing back in this nostalgia for what used to be.
Or what they think used to be.
Or what they think used to be, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I think, you know, here in Germany, they had a word for it, Ostalgie, right? Which was a mishmash of the words Ost for East and Nostalgie for this nostalgia for the East. And a lot of it is very colored, remembering only what was good and forgetting what was really, really hard and how much they really longed for freedom. And one of the fascinating things to me about Merkel is she has never, ever, ever lost sight of that. For a long time, I think she was a little afraid to talk about this idea that she fought as an Easterner. You know, she lived through the collapse of one system. She did not want to relive that. She did not want to live through the collapse of another. And that for her, the idea of freedom and of democracy was hard fought and won, and that she has always sort of kept it very present. And I think maybe not enough, that because she remembers, but there seem to be a lot of others who've forgotten.
Or have chosen
to forget. Right. Yeah. Right.
Are Germans at all looking at the midterm elections, which as we speak are just about a month away?
Yes, my inbox is filled with requests. Can you explain to us? Can you predict for us? And I'm like, no, I don't know. Certainly after the 2016 election, I'm sort of camera shy. There's a real hunger here in Germany to try and understand what is going on in the United States. I think there's a lot of confusion and a lot of... Initially, there was a lot of dismay because the United States taught Germany, or taught the Germans, democracy. The United States showed them, with the Brits, but they really, especially the West Germans, really looked to the U.S. for that leadership in issues like democracy, human rights. We didn't always get it right, and they were aware of it. They pushed back at times against this, you know, throughout history. You know, in the 80s, we saw street protests during the Iraq War. But at the end of the day, their compass was sort of pointed across the Atlantic. And I really get the sense they feel they've lost that. Their dismay has turned a bit to disillusionment and anger. There's still a little hope that maybe somehow the United States will resume its role of leader at the table of international order. But at the moment, they are very eager to see what the outcomes of the November election will be.
Well, it's going to be interesting on both sides of the pond. Melissa Eddy, I want to thank you so much for giving me time here today. We could talk for another 4 hours and not even scratch the surface, but it's been such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. I'm thrilled at your interest and your audience's interest in Germany. I think, you know, it is a strong alliance, this transatlantic alliance, and we have to do what we can to keep communication going. So thank you.
Melissa Eddy is a correspondent for The New York Times based in Berlin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, who is in Berlin on a fellowship through the Rias Foundation. You can find a link to the blog Bonnie has written from Germany at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then how the unique experience of an adoptee informs a new short film project. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Growing up, Emily Keister felt like an outsider in her own small-town Wisconsin community. As a transracial adoptee, Emily navigated life without feeling completely part of either white or black culture, something that was jarringly obvious once she moved to Milwaukee for college.
On the opposite end of the cultural spectrum, Milwaukee native Santana Coleman grew up in a large black family in the city and moved to Platteville for college. Fast forward to their post-college history when Emily and Santana met while working together at 371 Productions.
The two were working on a film idea for a black public media fellowship when Santana thought Emily's experience ought to be a short film itself called Black Girl Training.
The film follows Mia Kosh, an adopted black girl in a white community who doesn't know anything about being black. Now, as an adult preparing to meet her biological family, her friends seek to help her get ready and find her blackness. The project aims to tackle race, identity, stereotypes, and expectations in both a funny and celebratory way. Black Girl Training director Santana Coleman and producer Emily Keister joined me in the studio recently to share how their project developed. Emily starts by explaining her childhood experience.
I was adopted and raised in a small town in Wisconsin, Avoca, Wisconsin, which like no one has ever heard of. And so I grew up in a white family in a very white community. And it was really only like me and my little brother were like really the only two black people in the town. So I spent the first 18 years of my life there. And then I moved to Milwaukee and I was super excited because I was just excited to be around like people who look like me and be around diversity and all of that. And I quickly realized that I really didn't know anything about black culture. I didn't pick up on a lot of the references and the jokes and the dance moves. I just felt very like outside of the community that I just assumed I would just like fit in with and be perfect. So I kind of went through like a roller coaster of like, you know, am I black enough? What are black people going to think of me? What do white people think of me? Just like being kind of on the outside. And yeah, it was just talking to Santana and Jasmine. I was like explaining like, oh, like this happened when I was in sixth grade and this happened when I was, you know, in kindergarten. And it's not just a story about adoption. It's not just a story about, you know, feeling outside of your community. It's like the combination of those two and all of the things that I had to go through as I was growing up.
Well, and expecting an easy transition.
Right.
And yet having a whole nother coming of age, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. So I was like figuring out how to live in a city because, I mean, my town was like 600 people. So just to transition from moving to a really, really rural town to Milwaukee to being around people that, you know, I'd never really been around anybody except for white people. So I didn't know how to act, didn't know what to say. And I just like constantly felt like people were going to see that I wasn't black enough, and then they were going to point that out, and I didn't know how to respond to it. Yeah. And then at 21, I was legally able to get the information to find my birth parents. So then I kind of started to go down this road of like, well, what are my birth parents going to think? Are they going to think I'm black enough? Like, are they going to be able to tell that I was raised by a white woman, and how are they going to think about that? And are they going to be disappointed in me? Are they going to be happy for me? Like, is this the life that they wanted to give me when they gave me up for adoption? So it was just a lot of feelings and a lot of emotion that kind of drove me telling Santana and Jasmine, and they were like, all right, well, that's a great film and it's a comedy. And I was like, okay, I'm on board, let's do it.
Yeah, so the comedy is called Black Girl Training on the premise that the character is preparing to meet her birth parents but needs to train how to be black because she was raised by a white family. So, you know, you two found yourselves as the only black women in the local production company here, 371. How does this influence how you want to operate your production of this project?
Well, we definitely wanted an all-woman crew. Like, initially, that's what I really, really wanted. But we live in Milwaukee. It's hard to find all women that work in film here. So that kind of just wasn't possible. And then also, just as we get to, as I get further in this process, I realized that sometimes having people that you trust or that you know might be the better way to go sometimes. So in some areas, we're letting like our DP pick her AC and things like that, just because that's who she's comfortable working with and that's who she's most familiar with. But I think still the most important thing to us is having a mostly woman cast or crew, having a diverse crew. So we want to try to go with people of color as like our second priority, and then I guess kind of white males at the end, sorry to say, but I mean, that's kind of like the reverse of what it is in real life. So we really just want to shine on some women and some people of color during this process.
So Emily, this is, you know, your story in much of the sense, yet you're going to be producing it as a comedy twist. Mm-hmm. What are you being mindful of going forward when you're so closely connected to this?
Yeah. There's a lot. I think, especially like as we've really dove into like pushing out and like getting people to know about Black Girl Training, it's been a really vulnerable experience to me, because obviously people are asking me really personal questions about my adoption and about, you know, really focusing on some of the negative things that, you know, went into growing up with all white people. So I always just really try to stay mindful of the fact that like, there are stereotypes that are kind of being portrayed on both sides, towards white and towards black people. And I've been able to kind of live my life like being able to break both sides down, being able to really come at all viewpoints with very objectively and with a perspective that, I mean, that's very, very unique because I was raised by a white family, but also I spent a lot of time just with people in general that are very diverse. So I try to be really mindful of the fact that like while we are touching on some of the stereotypes, like some things are very ugly and we need to talk about them. So I think a strength with Black Girl Training is that we're able to kind of confront these stereotypes, but do it in a way that allows people to kind of laugh and allows people to look at things from a new perspective. Because if we don't talk about them, if we just keep trying to ignore some of these things like that come with growing up with people who don't look like you, and that come with not having idols that you can rely on that like kind of emulate your own appearance, like those things, we have to be able to talk about them, we have to be able to conquer them. And this comedy has just been a way that I've been able to use my voice and my experience to like really bring a lot of communities together and like allow them to see inside of the other community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that balance of celebrating and combating stereotypes. So can you give me any examples? You know, I don't know how far you've written into the project yet, but any examples of any situations or scenarios that you have in mind that you lived in real life that you want to change that narrative of when portraying it in your film?
Yeah, a little bit more in the series, because the film is really only 10 minutes, so we don't get to touch on everything within those 10 minutes. But in general, like the story of Black Girl Training, I really want to talk about. A big thing for me is having realistic idols within, like, children growing up. I didn't grow up with, you know, watching TV with black women or watching movies with black women or having, you know, all my dolls were white and all my friends were white and all the pictures of, you know, here's the images that you should strive to look like were like, you know, like white women. And so just seeing that and then now being an adult and reflecting on how that affected my own self-image, like for the first like 18 years of my life, that's a really, really big thing that I want to combat. And I think that what happens in the story is that our main character is so focused on, you know, how am I going to be black enough and how am I going to check all these boxes on like a black culture millennial list. And it's not towards the end of the film that she realizes like it's really more important about how you view yourself and making sure that you view yourself in a really nice light and that you're proud of yourself. And that's also a really strong image that I'm trying to portray with Black Girl Training, because it really, really matters on and how much you love yourself, and that is what you need to lead with when you're kind of making big decisions like meeting your birth parents.
Exactly. With this balance of, you know, addressing stereotypes but also poking fun at both sides, it's Black Girl Training, you know, and we're talking about the Midwest, you know, and it could be vastly different handbook for Black Girl Training for the South or Northeast or, you know, name any region of America. So, Santana, you know, what quintessential Midwest experiences as a black woman stuck out in your mind to include in this project? Because you had the opposite experience of growing up in Milwaukee and then going to college in UW-Platteville.
Right.
And experiencing what Emily had for the first 18 years of her life. So how did those two experiences stick out in your brain to be like, all right, this needs to be included in Black Girl Training?
Okay, so I guess I can say, what's crazy is that, so I'm still in the fellowship with Black Public Media, which is where I started and why, you know, I had to come up with the whole idea for a film. And my mentor, Rachel Watanabe Batten, she is a woman who was adopted as well, which is crazy. And she is a filmmaker who's worked in documentary and narrative. And one of the things, she told me a lot of things as we were like planning for the film and like structuring things out. And a lot of things she wanted me to think of really deep and make decisions about. And I just felt like those decisions weren't necessary. Why do I have to think of these things? Like, oh, what are her parents going to be? Are they German? Are they Scottish? And I'm like, who cares? Like, what is that? But I really realized that a lot of the things that she was asking me was because of stuff like this. So I've never been asked that question besides from her. She felt like she's from New York and she lives in New York, and she felt like it was really unique that our story was based in the Midwest and that we're from the Midwest. And she wanted me to like bring out Midwest things. But I guess from my perspective, I don't know what Midwest things are because this is just my life. Like, this is just regular for me. So I don't know what is here that's not there or what, you know. So there are things that was very important for me to add into the film, and that's important for me to even teach Emily through our real life Black Girl Training. But I don't know how Midwest they are or like where they, you know, if they only do that here kind of thing. But just a few of those things were watching Friday, which I think is, of course, probably a universal thing. Mm-hmm. Watching just black movies in general and black TV shows in general that mean something to us. Moesha, Living Single, Girlfriends, things like that. How to make Kool-Aid was one of the things that we're going to explore in the film, and like how much sugar you should put in it and things like that. Walking in and out the house and not like letting the air out when you're at your grandmother's house, because she's not going to let you just keep walking in and out. She's like, you're either in or you're out. Just a lot of those lessons that we learned as kids and that we look back on and laugh at was really important for me to be able to put that in there.
So we got a lot of nostalgia of childhood and growing up.
Yeah.
But for both of you, having experienced rural Wisconsin, you know, you growing up and then your little taste of it in college, I want both of you to give me like a positive memory that stuck out in rural Wisconsin and then vice versa, a Milwaukee memory. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, during the story, like, obviously we spend a lot of time, like, talking about, like, you know, why being raised in an all-white community was tough. But, like, there are things about my childhood that I'm, like, so unbelievably thankful for. And I think the biggest thing is, like, my sense of community is so rooted in, like, small-town Wisconsin. So I grew up in a place where, like, everybody knew me and everyone in my community was, like, so driven on keeping all the kids safe. And, like, I grew up knowing that, like, I could walk across town and, like, if I did something, you know, not reckless, but, like, as, like, a, you know, young teen Emily, like, if I was doing something stupid, like, my neighbor would call my mom and my mom would drive the car, like, across the street and be like, Emily, get in the car. We're going home. Like, I couldn't
drive
get
across the street.
Well, not when I say across the street, it's because my town was, like, literally four streets. So, like, across the town and across the street were pretty much the same thing. But, yeah, just, like, you know, like, when we would have big community events, like, literally everyone in the town would show up and everyone knew everyone. And, well, obviously, you can't really have any secrets in a small town. Just the amount of, like, love that I received and then a number of people that, like, really helped raise me was amazing. So that's really positive. From my perspective.
All right. And Santana?
Okay. So I guess one of my personal or one of my positive experiences. Well, I have a few. I'm not going to lie. I have a few. Platteville was a situation where all the black people that were there kind of knew each other because it was such a small circle. But it also kind of made for like a reality show because it was so much drama in those little group of people. Like everybody date the same person and everybody. It was just ridiculous. So it made for bad memories because it was a lot of drama. But it also made for good memories because we would all have parties and stuff. And we, you know, you just like knew everybody. And my husband came to college with me. And, you know, we had our son there. So, well, we didn't have him there, but I got pregnant there and we were living there with our son. And there's a lot of great memories there from us having our first apartment together, our next apartment, and just like all the apartments where we have so many memories of Auden learning to walk there and crawl and like different memories from like black owned businesses there. Like there were a few black owned restaurants there and we would all go there and, you know, like just things like that. I remember stuff like that. And then I also have memories just from being in college, working on campus, going to school on campus and the fun things we used to do on campus and some of the food that was so good. Like, you know, things like that is really what I have memories of. There's nothing I can pinpoint that is specifically because it was a small town. It was safer. You know, you didn't really have to worry about gun violence there like you do in the city, but it still didn't feel safer because I'm an outcast. I'm black. Don't nobody know me. Like when they see me driving, they're going to pull me over and I'm going to continue to get tickets because that's exactly what happened and mess up my license. So being in a safer place as far as like gun violence was fine, but I honestly feel safer in Milwaukee than I did there. So
right. Well, and vice versa with your Milwaukee experience, you came back home.
Yeah.
And then you transitioned to the city. So you know, what were your first impressions of Milwaukee, both positive and negative?
Yeah. So when I moved to Milwaukee, I didn't, like, know anyone in the city. I had just moved to UWM for college. And I remember just, like, being so scared because Milwaukee was so big. I was like, I don't know. If I have to go get gas, where do I pick, like, how do I find, there's only one gas station in my town, I know where I'm going, but, like, here, like, it was, everything was so big, and everyone I met was so new, and I think it's a pro and a con that everyone I met really challenged me, because it, like, people here really made me think outside of my circle and outside of everything I knew, and that was really, really hard to, like, break, you know, my rhythm of how I've lived my entire life and to think differently and to kind of like try to look at the world through someone else's eyes. That was really new and it was hard at first. But then I kind of like really found my activism here. And as I started to learn a little bit more about Milwaukee, you know, people are always talking about the gun violence and the crime and all of like the bad things you see here in the city. But then when I moved here and I fell in love with the city, I just saw so much beauty and like every person I met was just so amazing, like regardless of where they came from. So I really started to like see and take all of these facts that like I already knew about Milwaukee, but then let them feed into my activism and how I'm, you know, how I want to change gun violence in Milwaukee and how I want to be part of that conversation and then how I want to educate other people. I don't know, Milwaukee has definitely pushed me to like be a version of myself that I never thought I could be, but I'm very, very happy that I am.
I think the best part of Milwaukee to me is just that it's home. Like, it just feels like, oh my God, I remember so many times driving back to Milwaukee, like for a weekend or for a holiday from Pleasantville. And it's like, soon as you get on the freeway and you start to see like all the big buildings and the lights, I think it's probably around, not State Fair, it's a little further than State Fair. But
like Brookfield.
I think Brookfield.
Joseph. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. I would just be like, yay, we're here. Like, I would just be so happy. And I could, like, the memories of just being on the road at nighttime, almost to my mom's house, and just seeing all these lights and being like, oh my God, I miss this. Seeing all the people drive fast. And we're like, yay, people are finally driving like they have a destination to go to.
Right.
And just seeing all the colors and just like, oh my God, I miss that feeling. Like, that's like no other. And the crazy thing is that now I live in Cudahy, and I have to cross that bridge to get back and forth to downtown. And so every night, if I'm going into downtown, I get that big city view again, and it's amazing. And I don't know, it just feels like home. It just feels comfortable. It feels better to just see people that look like you, and it's just to see the diversity all around and not just go into a place where you feel like you're the only one of your kind and everyone is like looking at you or something like that. I also love that now that I'm getting older, I'm really starting to see how much Milwaukee has. We have so much cool stuff here. We have so many cool people here that are doing dope things, and that, you know, it's really underground until you really start to get out there and network and talk to people. And I just think that Milwaukee has so much personality and good about it that we don't really get to see much.
Well, Santana and Emily, thank you so much for coming in to talk about Black Girl Training, and I really look forward to the finished product.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Santana Coleman is the director of the upcoming short film Black Girl Training, which is based on producer Emily Keister's life. You can find more information about the project at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then learn how company break rooms are evolving in the 21st century. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There was a time when the corporate break room was a hodgepodge of vending machines selling bitter coffee, stale sandwiches, and those cheese and cracker sandwiches in Day Glow Orange.
Those kinds of break rooms are largely gone from the scene, replaced in some larger companies by catered kitchens, which offer a variety of entrees and snacks. But a Menominee Falls company is pioneering a new model for companies that aren't quite large enough to warrant an on-site restaurant, but want to offer fresher options than a vending machine.
Tim Taylor is the CEO of Davians, which created the concept of the micro market. I met him in one of those markets, which is located in another Menominee Falls-based corporation, the industrial technology conglomerate called Actuant. Katrina Gongola is vice president of global talent there. Taylor explained how his food service company has evolved.
We started in 1958 with a handful of vending machines, and we continued to grow and develop. In 1990, we built a new facility in Menominee Falls where we added extra services. The idea here was that we wanted to provide all food service solution to our clients, including events, catering, vending. And then in 2011, with the demand for healthier eating, the micro market concept was developed. And how this helps us accomplish that is we are able to offer up to 500 different items here, where in the traditional vending industry, you've got 35 selections. So it's not only just a different experience for our paying customers, it's really, really been our fastest growing segment here, and we're very excited about the future.
What is it about a market like this? I mean, this is really, as we stand here, this is not much larger than the size of a typical break room at any company. I'm thinking it's probably about the size of the kitchen we have at our radio station. What is it about this that speaks to what you wanted to accomplish?
We're limited in what we have available. We don't have the room or the size for a full kitchen, so we have to do with what we have available. And when we started talking to Davians about how to make changes, for us it was about healthy eating. It was about keeping people here on site rather than going out and going into your fast food. So how do we do that? And we kept challenging them to bring in different ideas. We love the fresh market idea, and we said, well, what more could we do? For them, it was we could bring in hot food in a certain way that still meets any licensing requirements that we have. We have the ability to bring in cold food in terms of a salad bar daily, in terms of a yogurt fresh bar, and we keep challenging them. Our next one is going to be oatmeal bars, fresh oatmeal and fresh toppings, so that people can feel they can eat healthy and yet stay on site.
Do you work together to kind of develop menus?
We do. Actually, Aaliyah is our on-site individual, and we absolutely adore her. We're talking constantly about what works and what doesn't, and how to bring in more. We know people love our Baja enchilada soup, and how do we do that more often? We also do catering on a regular basis so that people get a wide variety of food.
Well, and in a way, this feels kind of like catering. I mean, I imagine that there's not an on-site kitchen here, right? You're making it and bringing it in?
Correct. All of our products are made fresh locally right here in Menominee Falls and delivered here and refreshed daily from our certified route staff. And then the other portion of our food service here, which we're talking hot entrees, salad bars here that are available, are really managed from our on-site attendant. The concept here is completely customizable. Katrina talked about her limited space here, so our build out here is customizable to any space and also will accommodate anywhere from 100 to 1,000 employees.
How many employees do you have?
We have around 220.
And so at any number of companies around the Milwaukee area, there are different versions of something kind of like this.
Correct. It all depends on a number of employees and how we build it out, how many coolers we have to accommodate the volume and need of fresh food or beverages. So really what we do is we listen to the client, figure out what their needs are, including their wellness needs, and move forward accordingly.
That's a perfect transition here. I was going to ask you how this fits in with your corporate wellness goals.
We actually have been talking with Davians quite a bit about providing more fresh options. For us, we do have an ActWell program here on site. We have a gym downstairs where people go in and work out daily. So they're looking for food that they can quickly grab when they head back to their desk, and that is healthy options. So having salads, having fruits and vegetables that are fresh that people can grab and go are really appealing.
Well, so let me ask you, you have salads available, you have a yogurt bar available, and these healthy options. As we stand here, you also have a jalapeno popper flavored Cheetos, and you have Nutter Butter cookies. How do you encourage employees to maybe reduce the number of times that they choose Doritos versus the number of times that they choose something healthier?
When we communicate to the employees what's available, we downplay some of the treats and snacks. Yes, we have them available, but I have to be honest, most people gravitate towards the fresh salad. They're going to grab that. They're going to grab a hot sandwich quicker than they're going to grab Doritos.
The back-end software for the Davians Fresh Market, we have a portal which gives us access to group purchasing habits. And this is a portal that we can share with the clients so they know and understand if their wellness education programs are having an impact or where they may want to focus on any type of additional programs such as a subsidy or a reduced price on some of the healthier products.
So you're not charging them $10 for Doritos, though.
No, that wouldn't be effective. But really, with the 500 items here, the paying customer has plenty of options here, but yet still has access to their traditional branded snacks.
And that was a flip question, but you're not tracking individual employees and exactly what they're eating?
We are not. We don't have that capability, but we do have the ability to summarize all purchasing habits. Now, on the paying customer level, there is what's called the daily nutritional analysis. So they, as they sign up and use a membership here, they can then go in and track their nutritional values for each of their purposes. And if they had a need to monitor anything like sodium or cholesterol, they can put in alerts when they've exceeded the levels that they're concerned about. So really, this is about making healthy choices, and it keeps the employees engaged in the whole program.
So talk about before and after. Before there was a micro market in this space, what was here?
Before, there were two very loud coolers that had very little food in it. We did that because we were trying to keep costs down. But when we really looked at what we were doing, bringing in the Fresh Market and then going into Fresh Market Live gave us the opportunity to provide a lot more options for everyone and yet still maintain our volume and what we're offering to employees and spending on the food available.
We should take, can we walk over and take a look at, or an audio look at what's in this cooler?
Yeah. So we've got I'll just start with what's right in front of me here. We've got a Greek salad. We've got a turkey bacon and Swiss. Looks like we've got a chef salad, beef tips in gravy, turkey cheddar, roast beef and provolone. But then again, too, we've always got some staple items here, some impulse buys, some high protein, hard-boiled eggs are a really big seller. Our cheese, string cheese is a big seller. We've got some yogurt parfaits, always an assortment of milk. And that's kind of, we've got a veggie box here, a grab-and-go veggie box. We have a whole line of protein boxes, too, that are really, really hot. But really, there's a little something for everybody. And then we can talk about our beverages. With the space of this market here, it allows us to offer some higher-end brands, some healthy options. We've got naked juices over here. We've got, you know, sparkling water has made a big comeback. So we've got a great variety of that. Then, of course, your juices. Little something for everybody here.
Are there incentives for people to keep track of their own, either caloric intake or sodium or, you know, the kinds of things we hear about in wellness programs all the time?
There absolutely is. With our Act Well program, we are asking people to track not only their fitness, but their intake and how they're approaching their own wellness activities.
So let me ask, how often are you eating here?
I eat here probably 4 days a week, sometimes both breakfast and lunch.
Do you have favorites that are on the menu?
I absolutely do. There are some things that I really like. I tend to lean towards the sensible solutions, which is a great way for us to quickly see something that's a little bit lower in calorie. So some of the sandwiches that I really enjoy, but I also do love the availability of the soups. I'll lean towards those, and then twice a week we have eggs and sausage, so I tend to go for that.
Well, thank you to both of you. This is really interesting stuff, and I wish you the best of luck in moving forward.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Tim Taylor is the CEO of Menominee Falls-based Davian's, and Katrina Gongola is vice president of Actuant. The company, also based in Menominee Falls, is one of the sites where Davian's has developed what it calls a micro market. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.